back with Prince Caspian on chapters 3 and 4. So to remind us of where we ended, it's been a year since the Pevensey children had their adventures in Narnia. When they were in Narnia, they were there for years and years and years after they defeated the White Witch, and they were crowned kings and queens of Narnia, and they basically grow into mature adulthood in Narnia before they inadvertently stumble back through the wardrobe back into England, where they find out that no time at all has passed and they're little children all over again. It's been a whole year since then. They were
like a soap opera.
The holidays, however, have come to an end, and they were preparing to ride separate trains back to school. But then they have been magicked away somehow, found themselves first in a wood, then by water, then realizing that they are on an island. Then exploring the island, they find a ruin. In the ruins, they realize it's something they ought to have been very familiar with. Where were they in actuality?
Their old castle.
Mm-hmm. They were in Caer Paravel all this time, and they did not realize it, because apparently hundreds of years have passed. And what was a functioning, lively castle has, over that period of time, become an abandoned ruin. But they were able to trace the steps downward into the treasure room. They found, what did they find?
Their gifts
from Father Christmas. Okay. Peter finds what?
A shield
and sword. A sword with which he killed the wolf. Susan finds what?
Her bow,
but she does not find
the horn.
Lucy finds what?
Her bottle.
Okay, that heals people. And Edmund finds what?
Nothing.
Because he did not get it.
He was
enthralled by the witch by the time they actually received the gifts.
He does have a flashlight.
He does have a flashlight.
A torch.
But you gotta save the batteries. So they remember to save the batteries, and they've all kind of decided to fall asleep there amidst their ruined castle, all just sort of huddled together. And that brings us to the beginning of chapter 3. Mm-hmm. So the beginning of chapter 3,
you sleep in the morning, I wake up very early.
You do. The sun has a way of doing that to you, and the sun comes up when it wants to come up. So what plan do they make? Now that they're up and it's the next day and they know where they are.
They have to get off the island. They're hungry and they're tired of apples.
Right. So they do know they're in Narnia.
Yeah.
They don't know why they're in such in time there is such a distance between when they were last in Narnia, but they do know they're in Narnia. But there's nothing for them here on this island. We need to move on and see what else we can find, if only to have something to eat other than apples. So what do they decide to do?
Well, they need to find a way to get off of the island. So they start
swimming.
Yeah, crossing the water. And
that's not a very viable option.
Why not? Why is it a viable option?
Because Edwin doesn't know how to swim.
Edwin and Lucy were going to have a real hard time.
Nick,
Susan and Peter could probably make it okay. Susan says, you're really not supposed to swim when you don't know what the currents are, which is actually quite prudent. So they're thinking they're a little bit stuck. Yeah. Now, interestingly enough, what does Edmund have to say about not being able to swim?
Well, he said they did a lot of things that they weren't able to the last time they were in Narnia.
Right, they learned a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And just because I can't swim as a 11 or 12 year old boy in England, I could swim as a 25 year old king of Narnia. So, kind of who knows? But before they can settle that and come up with a viable plan, something happens. Before they see the boat, they figure something out about the passage of time.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That if they can leave the real world and be gone and become old and everything, when they return to the wardrobe, they're back to the same age. So that's right. So that what happens in Narnia,
there's always one.
Years go by a lot faster in Narnia. So
imagine it like this. In a place like, say, the airport, sometimes they will have an escalator and they will have stairs kind of next to each other. I used to love in the Orlando airport to ride, I don't know if places still have people movers anymore, but people mover is.
You stand there and it moves.
Yeah, you stand there and it moves.
That's the best thing.
So if you can imagine, okay, so you've got an escalator and stairs, and you can ostensibly, ride the escalator just moving. And it's moving at its own rate. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't stop. It just keeps going. So as soon as you step on it, you're just moving at this particular rate. Now, someone going up the stairs, they can go faster, they can go slower, or they can keep pace with you because they're able to adjust their speed. On the people mover, so you have somebody who can be walking next to you and you're just standing here on the people mover. Did you ever walk on the people mover?
Yeah.
You take normal steps and suddenly, zoom, you're way past them. And there's no way they can keep up unless they start sprinting. Mm-hmm. So we've got these parallel time streams where time in our world, in England, in the, 1942, maybe 1943, that time is moving at a certain rate. And now you've got a different place. Narnia has its own time stream, and it's moving at a different rate. Now, on that time stream, just like being on the people mover, you're walking normally. You don't feel like you're running. But in relation to the person who is not on the people mover, you're taking off like a rocket. So normal time in Narnia feels normal to them. It doesn't feel like dog years or anything. It just feels normal. But it's moving at a different rate than our time here because it is a completely different world. Not just a different planet, but it's like a parallel dimension maybe that you've got kind of its own set of rules. And so within that set of rules, to be in England for a year is equivalent to how long in Narnia?
Hundreds of years.
Enough time for woods to grow, for trees to get overgrown and start planting themselves through the apples falling and stuff, all the way to push through a gate for a strong, beautiful castle to fall into complete disrepair. For an isthmus to turn into an island. That's how long this has all taken. So, as a matter of fact, Peter comes up with a little illustration. Anybody remember his illustration? As though Crusaders, Anglo-Saxons, or ancient Britons somehow appeared in modern England. So, if, for instance, Let's make up a number. Let's say 300 years, just for fun. But I mean, if you're talking about an ancient Britain, you're talking about longer than that. You're talking a thousand years. But let's just say 300 years. So, what was going on 300 years ago here?
There was some kind of a battle.
Well, you're talking 300 years back from...
300 years ago in Lakeland, Florida.
Oh, I said nothing. I don't know what was that.
The missionaries.
Maybe Spanish missionaries.
Yeah.
Maybe, local Indian tribes you know, the Seminole or the Calusa or whomever, you know, 300 years ago, you're talking about there's a few English colonies way north of here. You know, 300 years ago, we are well before the 13 original colonies.
Yeah.
You know, imagining someone from, you know, from the very early 1700s showing up. The very early 1700s, let's see, who comes to mind? The very early 1700s, well, that's not early 1700s, but, you know, if Mozart showed up, mm-hmm. you know, that's kind of where we are with that. And this could be even further back, you know, imagine what that would, you know, how weird it would feel, not just for us to see this old guy, but you know, what about that old guy who's like, you don't understand any of this stuff going on, so.
Yeah, if you watch Mozart and, what's it, anyway, it's one of the shows on Netflix or something.
Okay.
And Mozart does show up to talk to the conductor of the orchestra.
Mozart in the Jungle?
Mozart in the Jungle.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay, so they decided, you know, we're going to have to try to figure something out, but before they can do that, they see a boat, and what happens with this boat? What do they notice about it, and what are the sequence of events?
There are two people.
Two people?
And
what kind of people?
Soldiers.
They've got armor or equipment or something on. And they've got what else with them?
A bundle
that clearly is moving.
clearly
moving. And so they hide themselves, they watch this interaction, and what happens here?
Well, Susan uses
her boat. Why? Why does Susan use her boat?
They were going to take him and drown him.
That's right. This bundle, they were going to drown. Now, you know, maybe they would just watch and see what was going to happen. But as soon as one of them is going to toss this wriggling, tied-up thing, you know, in order to drown it, that's when Susan doesn't wait. They don't formulate a plan. They don't. What does she do?
She shoots him in the head.
Yeah, shoots him in the head. Now, does this guy die?
No. Quite a shock.
No. He is actually knocked out of the boat, but is able to. It says he kind of scrambles up onto shore. What happens to the other guy?
He runs off
because
you don't want to get.
Yeah, my friend just got shot with an arrow. I'm out of here.
I guess we don't know that till later.
They make mention that these soldiers are uneasy being here. Why?
Yeah, because of the ghosts.
They're ghosts. This is a weird, creepy, spooky place.
Yeah.
And they don't want to be here any more than anyone else. And as soon as something goes wrong, that's more than enough reason to take off running. They're out of there. So they manage to rescue this bundled up bag. And who do they find? They find a dwarf.
You know what I have a question about?
Okay.
Here I go with questions, right? Why are they children if they're back in Narnia and not adults?
Well, let's look at it this way.
Are we going to find it out later?
No, this is. Okay, every time travel story should have some sort of internal logic, but because of the way our minds work, there's always a flaw in it somewhere. But this is what I would say. So, we've got two parallel lines here on this table,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay, we're going to call this line England in our time. And so the Pevensey children are here, and then they cross over into Narnia. And while this timeline does this, they go way over here.
Okay.
Now, by coming back, they go back to being children. Now, what magical properties, you know, why didn't they stumble back into England being, you know, 25, 30 years old like they were in Narnia? Don't know. But that seems to be the logic of how this particular system is set up. So they have now regressed in age.
Now and they're in a new adventure, so they're not.
And so now as they're going, now that they're heading back again, that age seems to be kind of a one-way thing. As you age in Narnia, you're not aging in England.
Yeah.
But you don't recapture that physical age by going back to Narnia. So the magic seems to only work.
They're starting a whole new adventure.
Yeah, they're starting a whole new adventure, and basically their lives, their physical lives have kind of restarted.
You need to watch soap operas. I keep bringing back these people that died.
Okay, so here we go.
My magic plan would make them adults again when they're right.
Okay, so.
I didn't think about it either. That's where my mind.
All right, so how would you describe this dwarf they find?
Well, he's a dwarf.
He's a dwarf.
Okay. So physically?
Physically, he's a
yeah,
dwarf.
Yeah.
And then he's got a, what, a red beard? Is this another red-headed? Is that another red-headed critter?
I don't think so.
Yes, he is.
He's red, but his beard's white. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
No, he has lots of red, coarse hair and a long red beard.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We're mixed up with the teacher.
All right.
Probably.
So, how would you describe his demeanor?
Kind of shifty.
Shifty?
Oh, I don't know if that's
he has a
girl.
Twinkle in his eye.
Yeah, I don't know if that was shifty as a good description, but he's not he's invasive, maybe is
okay.
A better way to say it.
All right.
But he's, like Pat says, he's got the twinkle and
he thinks they might be ghosts.
At least initially.
That would give him a reason.
But
to
I don't know. I want to say he seems really easygoing.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, he's assumed that he could have been killed any moment. He's been rescued. You guys aren't ghosts. And he's like, well, whether you are or whether you aren't ghosts, you saved my life. So we should probably have breakfast.
Right.
And he just seems kind of happy about it. Why would he think they're ghosts?
Because of all the legends.
There's legends. Even he has heard the legends.
Yeah.
So it's not just the soldiers who have heard legends.
Yeah.
He himself, as a dwarf, has heard legends about ghosts.
He's pretty inventive, or knowledgeable at least. He knew how to do the fish.
When he's kind of talking about himself, it's kind of, oh, I'm a dangerous criminal, I am, he says cheerfully. So he's happy as a clam about this. Why would he be happy about that? About being a dangerous criminal?
Because he got free of being murdered.
Okay. Yeah. We'll just have to find out some more later. So he has been, does he seem dangerous to them?
No.
He seems very good natured, and he seems very helpful. He figures out how to catch fish, and they go to have breakfast. And
they're all starving.
They're tired of apples.
Mm.
Yeah, so the fish is going to be great.
He's really hungry, and they're starving for something other than apples.
And so basically they all just kind of work together. Rather than there being a lot of suspicion, they don't know much of each other yet. They really haven't told each other. We don't even know this guy's name yet. Nor have they, I don't believe, said who they are.
No.
But they just all seem to be kind of on the same team. And we're going to have breakfast. We're going to get it all set up. And then now that they've done all that, we have finally eaten and cleared it away, and we can sort of be settled now.
And they figure
now they decide to sort of introduce themselves. Who goes first?
The dwarf
does. And how does the dwarf introduce himself?
He talks about Caspian.
Okay, who is Caspian?
He was the 10th king from Narnia.
Caspian the 10th king of Narnia.
And he's siding with the old Narnia.
Okay. That is to say, he ought to be king.
Oh, okay.
And at present, he is only king of who?
The old
Narnians. Well, what in the world are old Narnians?
Well,
There are people that came from Telmarian.
Okay, well, those are the Nunarnians. The Nunarnians are Telmarines.
Telmarines, okay.
Okay, they came from Telmar across the mountains. So now you've got Old Narnians and you've got New Narnians. These New Narnians, they're referred to as Telmarines. And who, what sort of creature is Caspian and these New Narnians from Telmar?
They're humans.
Okay. So the New Narnians are humans. Who do we think the Old Narnians then might be?
The pond and the animals.
All the old, you know, the ones we met before. The talking animals and the trees and the all that kind of stuff. So.
And the people who believed it.
Right. So he's trying to explain New Narnians and Old Narnians, and they're already their heads are already spinning, and they say it's worse than War of the Roses, which is, you know, very complicated issue that led to a rather lengthy war where who will be the next king of England, and we're down to, like, you know, the cousins of an uncle fighting against the whomever. It is on and on and on. So he says basically it's a long story. And what do the kids say?
Well, we love stories.
Great. Got all the time in the world. Let's tell a story. So, that'll take us to chapter 4. And we learn about Prince Caspian. Yeah. So, who is Prince Caspian?
The nephew of the king.
The king is Myraz. And he has a wife, Queen Pruna Prismia.
What a name it is.
Yep.
That's why it reminds me so much of
his father and mother were dead. So put two and two together for a second. He is Caspian the 10th, and his father and mother are dead, and his uncle is King of Narnia. Can you figure out sort of what's happened here?
He's the regent.
He must be the regent. Okay, so if he's Caspian the 10th, then his father was most likely Caspian the 9th, who was most likely King of Narnia.
Yeah.
And so if the King of Narnia dies, who's next in line?
The 10th.
Ostensibly the son is. But who's the king?
The uncle.
So the king's brother has become king,
because
and Caspian is considered the prince.
He's too young to be king. Not necessarily.
He still has
a nurse and a tutor.
Let's follow this for a moment. Okay, he didn't much care for his uncle. He loves his nurse. But every now and again, he would have to spend time with the king and the queen. And one day the king said, well, we have to teach you how to ride and use a sword. Why?
Because one day you're going to be king.
We have no children.
You might have to be queen.
So you might have to be king when I'm gone. So... working backwards, if Caspian the 9th dies, but his son is not the king, his brother is the king, how has this all happened?
Probably through
a battle of some sort.
Maybe, but it you would assume that Caspian would be
in line,
and maybe the uncle would be like a lord protector or regent or whatever, but he seems to act like he is the straight-up king, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you might have to be king since we don't have any children. Yes.
But he also didn't want anyone to talk about the old Narnians.
Right. Aha! So, let's get to that. Why did Caspian love his old nurse so much?
Because
Because she
told
them
stories.
Yeah.
And what were these stories about?
The old
Narnia.
Okay? With all the old animals that talked and the trees and the spirits and Aslan. And so at one point when they're having, Myraz is having this conversation with Caspian, and he's like, oh, maybe you'll be king one day since we don't have any children. And how does Caspian respond to that?
I don't care. I want what I wish for.
I wish, rather, you know, being king is not the thing that I wish for the most. What would I, what does Caspian wish for the most?
The old days.
Back in the old days. And suddenly, Myraz says, what old days?
Forgive you.
What old days? And some children, when they get excited about something, will just kind of keep talking without realizing that the tenor of the room has changed around them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So Myraz was barely paying any attention to Caspian at all. And it was kind of a there, young lad, until Caspian talks about old Narnia.
Yeah.
And suddenly, Myraz is paying a lot of attention. But Caspian didn't realize it.
No.
What does Caspian think is going on?
Then he's just curious about.
Yeah.
Sharing.
Oh, these stories are great, and don't you know about this and that and Aslan? Who's Aslan?
Yes.
And Caspian still doesn't quite know what to make of this.
He's still the excited child,
yes,
just talking about this.
That's right. And so, how does Myraz handle this? You will never speak of it again. This is baby talk, and these are fairy tales. You will be prepared for battles and wars. And
he sends away the nurse.
And who told you about this?
The nurse.
She's gone.
Yeah.
She's gone. She didn't even get to say goodbye. Boom.
No.
She's out. So when finding out who told me these stories, I kind of passed over this, but I'll get back to it. He actually grabs Caspian and starts shaking him. And Caspian is crying, says, stop that noise. Never let me catch you talking or thinking about those silly stories again. There were never those kings and queens. How could there be two kings at the same time? There is no such person as Aslan. There are no such things as lions. And there was never a time when animals could talk. Do you hear me? So, he drops the hammer then and there. The nurse is out of there. And who will Caspian have to replace her?
A tutor.
So think about that for a moment. This is not a system that we live in and experience, but how would you describe the difference between a nurse and a tutor?
A nurse is kind and caring and loving, and the tutor is more likely to be
learns his lessons. I mean, he teaches him things instead of telling stories.
Which type of children have nurses and which type have tutors?
Well, older children.
Well off, too. So, one of the details that is often not paid attention to in the Neverland stories is that Wendy, the oldest child, mm-hmm, was the one who used to tell the younger children all of these fantastical stories about Neverland and Peter Pan and pirates and mermaids. Mm-hmm. Having no idea they're actually real, but she used to tell them all these stories. And Peter Pan himself used to come and secretly listen. Why does Peter Pan make himself known and actually take Wendy away to Neverland? Anybody remember?
He wanted her to be his mother.
He did, but he could have done that at any time. But there was a specific reason why the time was chosen. Because the next morning, she was being sent out of the nursery.
Oh, okay. Because she had reached a certain
age. You have reached
the
age where you should not be in the nursery with the younger kids anymore. You are now becoming a woman, and that means your place is not with the nursery. your place is over here doing other things. And that was like this dividing line, like, I'm not a child anymore, I now have different responsibilities, and blah, 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 blah. And so, anyway, this was the loss of her childhood, and so Peter Pan actually snatches her last night of being a child. So this whole concept of, you know, a nurse in a nursery, it's not just, you know, babies, but that was a system where, you know, basically, yeah, preschooly, and maybe even beyond a little bit, but when you switch from a nurse to a tutor, that was like the difference between, you know, like being in kindergarten maybe to being at a desk in a school, writing on paper and having instruction. So, like overnight, he is being told, you're not a child anymore. And now you're going to be tutored. Why tutored? Why is he going to be tutored?
Because he has to be prepared to be king.
Be prepared to be king.
Yeah.
You know, this, you know, Myers might not be fond of Caspian, but, you know, Caspian is going to be the heir, so he needs to be qualified. So we're going to bring this guy in to teach him what he needs to know. So, who is the tutor?
Dr. Cornelius.
And how would we describe Dr. Cornelius?
Short.
He is
short?
Fat.
And a long gray beard.
Long gray beard.
I got him.
A pointed beard.
Yep.
Yeah. Very pointed.
Scary?
Yes.
No, not yet.
No, he looked very wise, very ugly, and very kind.
Yeah. And he had a twinkle in his eye that you couldn't quite tell when he was being serious and when he was joking.
But he was very likable.
Very likable and very, very knowledgeable.
In reading that, I wonder why that type of a tutor was selected.
That's a good question, but what we can assume at this point was he seems particularly well qualified. He seems to be extremely versed in every subject matter.
Especially history.
Mm-hmm. History, grammar, astronomy. I mean, all of these kind of classical pursuits, he seems to be very, very well versed in. So what is something that Dr. Cornelius tells Caspian early on that's quite a surprise to Caspian?
That he lived in there.
That the royal family were newcomers.
They were relative newcomers. They came from Telmar, beyond the Western Mountains, and his ancestor, Caspian the First, is also called?
Caspian the Conqueror.
Caspian the Conqueror. And what is Caspian's natural question after that?
Where did he come?
Yeah. If he's the Conqueror, and you're telling me there weren't many men around back in the day,
who did he conquer?
Well, how does Dr. Cornelius respond?
Whom? Not who.
Yeah, well, yeah. Sounds like it's time for a grammar lesson. Yes. But he shuts Caspian up.
That's it.
You know that your uncle doesn't want anybody talking about this. He would cut my head off. You would be in trouble. So be patient. And he makes a show of them moving on to a different subject. But a few days later, what does he do?
Takes him to an astronomy lesson.
For an astronomy lesson. And they are up late at night when everyone is asleep. And they're out on the great tower where there's no one beneath them and they could be in complete privacy. And
the door is locked.
Why is he there?
Because there are two things coming
together. Okay, there's some kind of celestial conjunction that's going to happen. Tarva, the Lord of Victory, salutes Alambil, the Lady of Peace. So victory and peace will come together. And this happens how often? This special conjunction?
Couple hundred years.
And he says, I have brought you here to see something that no living man has seen. And no living man will ever see again. It happened too long ago in the past, and no one will live long enough to see it occur again. Why? Why does he want Caspian to see this particular event?
Well, it has to do with the old Narnia, I think, because of what he goes on and tells them later.
Yes.
Yeah.
What you've heard about old Narnia is
true.
It tells them all these stories of the fauns and the satyrs and the naiads and the dryads and everything else. It's true, it's true, it is all true. That is who Caspian the First fought. So what was the end result of that war between Caspian the Conqueror of Telmar and the talking animals and residents of Narnia?
He defeated them utterly.
He says he silenced the beasts and the trees and the fountains, killed and drove away the dwarfs and the fauns, and now are even covering up the memory of them. So when Caspian the First conquers, they obliterate Narnia. They not only defeat and conquer them, they wipe them off of the history books. No one is to know who used to be here. No one is to remember what things used to be like. It's like the stories of the old Soviets, and when one, when Lenin dies and Stalin goes into power, then Stalin erases from the history books everything good that Lenin did and said, oh, he was a monster and he was going to be destroyed. And then when Stalin dies and then Khrushchev, and they erase a lot of stuff. Stalin, it's one of those things where that is how you not only hold power, but you try to make it so that who you conquered could never possibly rise again.
Yeah, it sounds like Trump and Obama.
This is salting the land after you have conquered it, so that it's just
growing.
Nothing can happen there again. They've sought to just wipe out all memory of Narnia. Many of your race wish in secret that we knew of these things to be true. But Doctor, why do you say my race? Aren't you a Telmarine too? Am I? Well, you're a man anyway.
Am I?
What happens?
He reveals himself.
Takes off the hood, and suddenly in the moonlight, all the puzzle pieces come together. He is not a man.
He's
There's features, and the size, and the weight, and the beard, and oh my gosh, he is a dwarf. Is he a dwarf?
He's a half dwarf.
Now, what does that mean, a half dwarf?
He has human blood. Basically, somebody must have mated with a dwarf.
That's right. So, when the dwarfs and the rest of the Narnians were conquered and driven either into hiding or just killed outright, how did a few of them escape, according to Dr. Cornelius? He said a few of them escaped. How? They cut their beards, they wore high heels, and they cast themselves off as short humans.
Yeah,
I remember.
Okay? And so that's how the bloodline of the dwarfs was sort of carried on, intermingling with their Telmarine conquerors. Okay, so he's not what he would consider a pure or full-blooded dwarf. He calls himself a half-dwarf. He's got dwarf blood, but at some point it's been mixed and mingled and everything else. How does he consider himself, a dwarf or a man?
Dwarf.
I think he considers himself a dwarf. He obviously passes as a man. Now, if he were to ever meet a real-life wild dwarf, how does he think that dwarf might treat him?
Badly.
Why?
Because he's mixed.
Mm-hmm. You're a traitor.
You're a traitor.
Yeah.
You're a traitor. Mm-hmm. The rest of us endured the suffering and the exile and the death. You and your people hid and cozied up and pretended. So he realizes that there might, this might be awkward, but what is his absolute fondest wish in the world?
For that to be brought back. The line to be brought back, of course.
But can it be?
No.
He doesn't, has he ever met a dwarf, a real dwarf?
No.
Has he ever met any of these old Narnians?
No.
But it's been his fondest desire, and he's looked all his life.
Okay.
And every now and again, I think I hear dwarf drums or the music of a faun, but by the time I get there, there is no sign of them whatsoever. Maybe it's all in my imagination. Maybe they're all long gone and dead, but I have never, ever, ever stopped looking.
He tells him you should try to be king, even like the High King Peter.
That's right. You will be king one day. I have shown you these things and I've told you these things. So that one day you can be a king, not like Myraz, the jerk, your uncle, but you could be a king like the High King Peter back in the golden age of Narnia. So all that's true, and the High Kings and the Queens and the White Witch and Aslan, he says, absolutely. Absolutely. Cair Paravel, over by the sea and by these woods, and this, the castle you're in, that's a Telmarine castle. He's like, bleh! The castle by the woods? Why does Caspian not like that idea?
Because of the ghosts.
That's where all the ghosts are. Everybody knows that. Why does everybody know that there are ghosts in that area?
That's what they've been told.
Why?
Keep them away from there.
That's right. Just like we're erasing the history books. Just like we're preventing anybody from talking about it, we don't even want people going into an area where they might uncover something and get them thinking why. So what you do is you make up stories that will deter anyone from going over there. If that island is haunted and full of ghosts, who's going to go over there looking and might inadvertently stumble over anything? Nobody.
A bunch of inquisitive teenagers.
Well, who gets stuck there magically, maybe.
And they're afraid of
Of the woods. Why are they afraid of the woods? Why are Telmarines afraid of the woods?
Because of the dwarfs and the...
That's what they live.
The spirits of the woods used to fight against them. Back in the war...
But where'd the spirits...
Oh, the trees had...
The trees had spirits, and the waters had spirits, and those were all the old Narnians. And so they still don't trust trees, and the trees still make them nervous. And why do they not like the sea?
Because Aslan travels by sea.
That's right. That's the old saying about Aslan coming over the sea, and just in case it happens to be true, it's just kind of in their memory that I don't like the ocean. I don't like it. I don't trust it. Even if they have no concept of Aslan, or only a very select few do, it's sort of drummed into them. Woods are spooky, and the sea is evil. All right? It is now. That's plenty for one night. It's time to go to bed. And they do, and that's the end of the chapter. But where has this brought us to?
Now the kids are going to have to tell who they are.
Okay.
That was the agreement.
I don't think his story is done yet, because we haven't connected this prince who just learned about old Narnia to this dwarf, their real-life dwarf. Remember, Dr. Cornelius wasn't even sure that such a dwarf existed anymore. Well, the kids are talking to him. He's the one telling the story. So at some point, the story of this prince, who knows a half-dwarf, who has told him about old Narnia, is going to somehow have to get connected to this real dwarf. We're not there quite yet.
No.
So there's more to this story still to be told. But as of now, Dr. Cornelius closes off with basically revealing... where things stand as of now. So, let's apply that to the Pevensey children. Why is Cair Paravel an ancient ruin?
Because it got destroyed in the battles.
Right? There's been battles and it's been purposefully abandoned.
Right.
You know, you can go to Europe and you can find a 1,000-year-old castle that still looks really nice.
Yeah, right.
But because they've been maintained continuously.
But you can find some that are
But you can find there's some ruins too.
Yeah. Some gorgeous ruins.
So Cair Paravel is an abandoned ruin. Why? Not just because of the passage of time.
Because the
inhabitants were dispelled. They were defeated, they were conquered, they were kicked out, and they were erased from history. So now these hundreds of years, enough time to have 10 Caspians. Okay, so even if they did exactly father, son, father, son, father, son, was always Caspian, 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 even still, you're talking about 10 generations.
Yeah.
And that's assuming there's no, you know, non-Caspians here and there. But there have been 10 Caspians worth of suppressing old Narnia, and now no one believes anything other than the woods are spooky and evil and full of ghosts, and the sea is dangerous and to be avoided.
Yeah. Now, in spiritual terms, how does all this apply? Is that like the old Narnians, or like the promised, the people that God made the promise to, in other words, the Jews and everybody else in this here, who has conquered everything?
I think that's an excellent thought, to try to make some parallel spiritual connections about maybe like the Babylonian captivity, mm-hmm. maybe like the faithful remnant of the Jews. So even though the land was conquered and overrun, and even their culture was obliterated, that somehow, you know, secretly they maintained. This could be like the Christians under persecution, mm-hmm. who hid in the catacombs, because it to practice your faith openly
you couldn't tell
meant
the
death.
Stories. You couldn't tell you the could, story.
You know, and that's the only way that the Gospels preserved for several generations was secretly telling the stories. You couldn't, you know, go out and proclaim them. Or you would be murdered, you'd be executed.
Yeah.
You know, and that's happened at different times in different places, not just early in the church history. Okay. But remember what I told you about what I use at the noon service. I use that red cloth, the antimens, as the Eastern Orthodox refer to it, because that developed for their need to have a portable altar. They've been under so much persecution for so long and in so many places, they had to learn how to worship corporately in secret and at a moment's notice grab everything and run. So you can't build an altar, you can't build a church. So they made out of that antimens, out of that one cloth, all the little symbols and things as though it were an altar. But if the soldiers ever came, or the government ever came, or if whomever ever came, they could wrap it up, they could hide it, and they could run.
Is there a relic in that intense?
There is, yes. So this could be actually compared to multiple times in church history. You know, anybody want to take a trip to see Constantinople? Because you can't.
There is no Constantinople.
That was one of the greatest cities in the world.
Yeah.
And it was the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire. And what is it now? Istanbul. Istanbul.
Does it have any?
And what about the churches that were there in Constantinople? What are they now?
Ruins.
No. They're mosques.
Yeah.
They're mosques. They changed the architecture. They knocked stuff down. They put stuff in. They've transformed what was once a church into a mosque. We're going to wipe out what used to be here. Are there any Christians who live in Turkey?
Yeah.
They're a minority. They're a persecuted minority. Are there any Christians? You know, okay, so you know, go back to the Antimens again and the Archbishop. This is Chaldean Orthodox. These are the Jews in the area of modern-day Iraq. So, for the past 18 years or so, what has happened? How many Christians are left in Iraq?
Not many.
Not many. Not many, because they have been, they've been exterminated.
Annihilated.
Yeah. Even they were tolerated for a long period of time, but they had to do everything in secret. Mm-hmm. But then, Saddam Hussein is out, the Ba'athist party is gone, and that brings in newer, more militant forms of Islamic government. And what happens to those Christians who were already the small little minority in there? The persecution only ramps up.
Yeah.
Can you bring a Bible into China?
No,
I'm not sure you can. I'm not sure you, like as a tourist, I'm not sure you can. Can you bring a Bible into China and give it to someone, a Chinese national?
Oh my God, you
absolutely
can't.
No.
No.
Absolutely
no.
Not.
No.
Okay. Are there any Christians in China?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Are there any Christians in North Korea?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
They are in Ivy.
Okay. So we are now, we've moved from one sort of Narnian persecution to another. We've moved from the, you know, kind of the imperial conquering of the white witch who transformed everything to suit her and made slaves of everyone. Closer to an Exodus story. Now, Prince Caspian, we're talking about being conquered and carried away. More, I think, of a captivity story or the underground church persecuted that has to remain hidden. And so, both of them have these elements of, being conquered and being oppressed and being secret and all that kind of stuff. But we've kind of shifted in the way that that's done. So you could be a fawn under the white witch as long as you swore allegiance to her and did whatever she said. You cannot be a fawn in the Narnia of King Myraz because your mere existence points to King Myraz that his rule is not a natural and eternal thing. No, you've not always been here. You were not the first here. You actually beat and conquered someone and you've taken something. They like to present themselves as, you know, just the natural rulers. This is just, it's our birthright, this is our stuff, and it's always been that way, and so shall it always be. So, an interesting change.
Oh, yeah.
Very substantial change, and slowly but surely this is starting to sink down into the Pevensey children as they try to piece together what exactly has happened.
If we can back up just a little bit, it isn't the children that go to sleep, is it? It was Caspian and his teacher that as that chapter ended.
Correct. Yeah. So we're going to get more. The dwarf is not done with his story.
Right. No.
So the next chapter there will be more that will continue what happens after Caspian learns the truth. Now he believed his nurse with these stories, but he was told what about those stories?
They're fairy tales
that are not true.
Not true.
They have now been confirmed and even deepened, not just by the stories of an old loving nurse, but by a scholar, by a man of great learning who has not only said, this is all true, but through his revelation about who he really is, has actually offered proof.
Yeah.
We've now moved from stories to you know the truth. But knowing the truth is rarely the end of the story. So we've got more to find out with what happens to Caspian next. So I guess we'll do 5 and 6 for next time.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
All right.